Well, we're starting a new sermon series just in God's providence. We just finished up a series when we stopped evening worship, so I'm going to be starting a new series studying the book of Deuteronomy. And so I invite you to turn with me to our first passage in Deuteronomy. Probably for a lot of this series, we will look at larger chunks of the book, but tonight we're looking at just the first five verses. So Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 1 through 5. Hear the word of the Lord. These are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel beyond the Jordan in the wilderness, in the Arabah opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel, Laban, Hazeroth, and Dizahab. It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. In the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, Moses spoke to the people of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him in commandment to them, after he had defeated Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth and in Edrei. Beyond the Jordan, in the land of Moab, Moses undertook to explain this law, saying, kind of a cliffhanger, a strange place to end, but that's where we're ending today. Thus far, the reading of God's holy and inspired word. May he add his blessing to it. So the book of Deuteronomy gets its name from the Greek translation of Deuteronomy 17:18, which translates the Hebrew phrase, a copy of this law, as second law. So that's where we get the name Deuteronomy. That's what Deuteronomy means. It means second law, the second giving of the law. But the Hebrew Bible actually has a different title for this book. In the Hebrew Bible, the title of the book is simply derived from the first phrase in verse 1. These are the words. And that's kind of a strange maybe name for a book, but that's the way they named their books at that time. But that phrase is significant because it's also the typical way that ancient Near Eastern treaties begin. These are the words of so-and-so, usually some great king who is about to set forth his treaty that he is setting up with some lesser king or some vassal nation. So this similarity between the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy and ancient Near Eastern treaties is not coincidental, the fact that they begin the same way. It's not a coincidence. Deuteronomy is a covenant document between the Lord and Israel, and it was patterned after those ancient treaties. The basic pattern is found in Deuteronomy, the basic covenantal pattern, and we'll see that as we study the book over the next few weeks and months. But Deuteronomy is one of the most significant books in the Old Testament, and we can see that by the fact that its language is so frequently used in the later history books. So the books that come after this, the post-Pentateuchal history books, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings especially, have a lot of Deuteronomic language in them. And Deuteronomy's importance in the overall canon is also made clear by the fact that it's quoted about 50 times in the New Testament. Only Psalms and Isaiah are quoted more frequently in the New Testament. Deuteronomy comes in third, even ahead of Genesis. Can you believe that? And you may be aware that when Jesus was being tempted by Satan in the wilderness, he responded to each of those temptations by quoting verses from the book of Deuteronomy. Now, the reason why this book is so important becomes clear when we consider the circumstances in which it originated. Moses spoke these words as the people of Israel were preparing to enter the Promised Land. And that's made very clear here in the opening five verses. So in delivering these words to his people, the Lord was renewing the Sinai covenant with them after their 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. God was exhorting his people to be faithful to that covenant when they settled in their new home, the land that he was giving them as their inheritance. Well, as we study the first five verses of Deuteronomy tonight, we'll see how they function as the preamble to the treaty document that follows. And they do two basic things. We see two basic things in these verses, and this is basically our sermon outline this evening. First of all, these verses identify the Lord as the great king who is in covenant with his people through the mediation of his servant Moses. And then second, these verses summarize the historical context, the historical background that explains why the Lord is able to make such demands upon his vassal, the people Israel. So you can see by just looking at verse 1 that Deuteronomy begins with Moses identifying himself as the author. Now you may be aware that this is a point that's actually contested in biblical scholarship. It wasn't contested up until about the 19th century, but beginning in the 19th century, the Mosaic authorship of the first five books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the Mosaic authorship of those books was challenged by a new theory, and the theory was called the documentary hypothesis. And it's also sometimes called JEDP theory. JEDP stands for four different sources that supposedly contributed to the first five books of the Bible. The scholars who hold to this view argue that the Pentateuch, again, Genesis through Deuteronomy, was compiled by an editor from four distinct sources who wrote many centuries after Moses' lifetime. And so the dating of these books is much later under this theory than it would be if we hold to the traditional view that Moses is the author of these books. Now, the main arguments in support of the documentary hypothesis are as follows. Number one, the Pentateuch has multiple accounts of similar instances. Okay, so like the couple of times where Abraham lies about Sarah being his wife and says that she's my sister. Okay, there's a duplicate incident there. And the assumption is that, well, that couldn't have happened twice. It must be two different sources and it got mixed up or something like that. And then another argument is, it uses different names for God. Sometimes he's called Yahweh. Other times he's called Elohim. And so that must indicate we've got two different sources here. And then there are some stylistic differences. You know, the book of Leviticus, very different from the book of Genesis, right? You know, very different style. And then sometimes these books list events out of their chronological order. Now, aside from the fact that the Bible itself identifies Moses as the author of the five books of the Pentateuch, multiple times it does, aside from that, the case for the documentary hypothesis is pathetic. It's really quite lame. And actually, a lot of critical scholars in recent years it's fallen out of favor even with them. And let me just point out some of the weaknesses of this view. I think it's helpful to know this because you may be talking with a non-Christian at some point, and they may say, oh, well, we know that the first five books of the Bible weren't actually written by Moses. And it's good to be able to kind of push back a little bit and say, how do you know? You know, and maybe help them to think about what they were told maybe in a religious studies class in college or whatever. But first of all, the documentary hypothesis has an anti-supernatural bias. Because of that, there's a number of things that flow out of that. One is it rules out the historicity of anything miraculous that's recorded in the Pentateuch. Also, it holds to an evolutionary view of Israel's religion. It assumes that Israel's religion was originally more primitive and maybe even polytheistic, and it grew into a monotheistic religion over time, into a more formal religion over time. It also presupposes, and again, there's no evidence for that, it's just an assumption that's read into the text. It also, as I noted before, it presupposes that multiple incidents with similar details must really be different tellings of the same event. And again, that just doesn't make a lot of sense. Have you ever had similar things happen to you? Have you ever responded to situations in similar ways? Also, the documentary hypothesis is self-contradictory at numerous points. It's highly subjective. It's not supported by any objective evidence. It ignores the fact that the historical accuracy of the accounts of the patriarchs in Genesis has been confirmed by a number of archaeological discoveries. And that's very, very early, you know, the patriarchs in Genesis. And then lastly, and probably most significantly in light of the lack of any other evidence, it simply ignores the evidence within the books themselves that point to a single author. So E.J. Young, Old Testament professor at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, put it this way. He said, "If the first five books of the Bible were put together in the manner which this hypothesis demands, it is difficult, if not impossible, to understand how the result could be the unity which the Pentateuch actually does exhibit." So Moses is the author of Deuteronomy. We can go along with what it says. We can take it at its word when it says these are the words that Moses spoke. But the text also makes it clear that Moses is not speaking for himself when he speaks these words. He is speaking for the Lord. As it says in verse 3, "Moses spoke to the people of Israel according to all that the Lord had given him in commandment to them." So in the Sinai covenant, Moses served as the Lord's mediatorial representative. And Moses had been in this role since the time of the Exodus, which was 40 years before the time that's described here at the beginning of Deuteronomy. As Old Testament scholar Meredith Klein notes, when the theocracy was established in the Sinai covenant, Moses was the earthly representative of the Lord's kingship over Israel. So Moses was in a very important role. There's a sense in which really all three mediatorial offices kind of came together in a certain respect with Moses, especially the offices of king and prophet. Maybe not so much priest. It was his brother Aaron who was the priest. But Moses certainly intercedes for the people at different points, performing priest-like functions. That's why he's such a significant figure in Old Testament history. So he is the earthly representative of God's kingship over Israel. But now, the Exodus generation is dead. You know, they've been wandering in the desert those 40 years until that generation died off. And now Moses himself is about to die. And so the three orations that this book consists of really function as Moses' farewell discourse. And as such, they prepare the way for a new leader for God's people. And we see this new leader emerging at the end of the book. In chapter 31:3, it says this, "The Lord your God himself will go over before you. He will destroy these nations before you so that you shall dispossess them. And Joshua will go over at your head, as the Lord has spoken." And then just a few chapters later in chapter 34, "And Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the people of Israel obeyed him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses." So there's a sense of dynastic succession here from Moses to Joshua, even though it's not a blood dynasty, you know, there's no blood relation between Moses and Joshua. Moses even lays his hands on Joshua. It's as if there's this sense of continuity between the two figures. And Joshua's succession of Moses as Israel's leader provided a prominent symbol of Yahweh's continuing theocratic lordship over his people. And that's an important theme in the book of Deuteronomy, making sure that that symbol continues even after Moses is gone. Now, the names and the time references that are contained in these first five verses are significant. They summarize the historical context of the Lord's covenant with Israel. And this is another element that's patterned after the treaties of the ancient Near East. Oftentimes in those treaties, the greater king would state what he has done for his subjects. And his purpose in doing that would be to establish why they're obligated to obey the terms of the treaty. I've done such and such for you. Oftentimes it would be something like, I've given you the privilege of being ruled by me, and therefore you need to obey me. So looking at these geographical references is helpful. The first reference is the phrase, beyond the Jordan in the wilderness, in the Arabah. Now this is repeated in verse 5 with a slight change where it also mentions the land of Moab. So this is identifying the place where Moses originally spoke the words of this book to the people of Israel. These words were delivered on the plains of Moab, just east of the Jordan River and north of the Dead Sea. So the people are not yet in the promised land yet. They're just on the brink of entering into the promised land. If you have a map in the back of your Bible, you can flip back and just look for that location. Just to the east of the Jordan, just north of the Dead Sea. That's the general region where they were. So these are the words that the Lord spoke to his people as they prepared to begin the conquest of Canaan and secure it as the setting for the theocracy that was set forth in the Sinai covenant. And then we have the next group of geographical locations, a string of names here, Suf, Paran, Tophel, Laban, Hazeroth, and Dizahab. And there are only two of these are named elsewhere in the Old Testament, but in general, it's assumed that these are probably the names of various locations that Israel passed through as they journeyed from Sinai toward Canaan. So again, this would have been the journey that they took 40 years prior to the time when Moses spoke these words to the people on the plains of Moab. And then we come to this sentence in verse 2. It is 11 days' journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. There is a lot of history packed into that sentence, and we need to unpack it. Where is Horeb? Well, Horeb is another name for Mount Sinai. Where is Kadesh Barnea? Well, Kadesh Barnea is the name of the town on Canaan's southern border where Israel camped as they awaited the report of the spies who were sent into the land. Again, this is right after the Exodus, right after the giving of the law at Sinai. 11 days' journey from Sinai up to Kadesh Barnea, and they sent the spies into the land, and they're waiting in Kadesh Barnea to hear the report of the spies. And we're told about that fateful event in Numbers 13. I want to summarize it for you and also the response in Numbers 14. So when the spies came back, they gave their report, and this is what they said. We came, this is from Numbers 13, we came to the land to which you sent us. It flows with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. However, the people who dwell in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. We are not able to go up against the people, for they're stronger than we are. The land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who can't come from the Nephilim. And we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." So you can see what they're conveying there. They're saying, we would be nuts to go in and try to take on these people. We can't do it. Well, after that discouraging report, we're told that that wasn't the only report. That was the majority report, but there was also a minority report. And the minority report was given by Caleb, and we presume Joshua as well, in light of what's said about him later. And they tried to persuade the people that the Lord would overcome these challenges for them. This is what they said. "The land which we pass through to spy it out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land that flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord. And do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their protection is removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." What a stirring speech, right? But in spite of that effort, the majority report prevailed. The people were disheartened, and they rebelled against the Lord. And this is what they said: "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Let us choose a leader and go back to Egypt." Well, as a result of that response, the Lord declared that they would get their wish. They would die in the wilderness. They would wander in the wilderness for 40 years until that rebellious generation died off. And here are God's words to them in Numbers 14. "As I live, declares the Lord, what you have said in my hearing, I will do to you. Your dead bodies shall fall in this wilderness. And of all your number, listed in the census from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me, not one shall come into the land where I swore that I would make you dwell, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun. But your little ones, who you said would become a prey, I will bring in, and they shall know the land that you have rejected. But as for you, your dead bodies shall fall in this wilderness." Now, with that series of events in mind, that background to what is said in verse 2, let's look again at what is said in verse 2. It only took Israel 11 days to travel from Sinai to the southern border of Canaan at Kadesh Barnea. They were on the brink of taking possession of the land of promise, of being established as God's holy nation there. If only they had followed Joshua and Caleb's counsel. But because of their unbelief, it would be another 40 years before their children, and not they themselves, would be able to enter the land. They did not believe that God would be faithful to what he'd promised, and the consequences were catastrophic. Israel's refusal to trust in what the Lord had promised resulted in 40 years of homelessness and affliction. Unbelief prevented an entire generation from entering that land that was a typological foreshadowing of heaven. Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't go to heaven, but it means they didn't get to enjoy this type, this earthly type that God had set forth to encourage and strengthen their faith. And this certainly is a warning to us, a warning against unbelief, a warning against disobedience and rebellion, a warning against not trusting the Lord to be faithful to what he promises in his word. So let us take care, lest there be in any of us an evil, unbelieving heart that will lead us to fall away from the living God and keep us from entering his rest. That's the way that the writer of the Hebrews applies that history to God's people today. Well, this brings us then to verses 3 and 4, which speak of Israel's conquests over the kings of the Transjordan region. And the two kings who are mentioned here are Sihon and Og. And their defeat is recorded for us in Numbers chapter 21. And these victories will be recounted in greater detail in Deuteronomy 2 and 3. But the mention of them here in the preamble to this treaty document highlights the fact that God has not abandoned his people because of their failure of faith. Though the wilderness generation proved faithless, God is still faithful. He's faithful to the promises that he made to Abraham and to the patriarchs. He will bring the descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob into the promised land, and he will give them possession of it. So God gave Israel a foretaste of the coming conquest of Canaan by conquering the nations in the Transjordan region, which became the inheritance of 2.5 of the tribes, the Transjordan tribes. And notice also that in these verses, God is described as the one who brought about the defeat of these kings. God is the one who defeated Sihon and Og. Although if you read Numbers 21, the people actually do fight, but God is the one who gave the victory. And this reminded Israel, in the words of one Old Testament scholar, that success in possessing the promised land lay not in military prowess and strength, but in an unbroken covenant relationship with the Lord, who alone could bring further victories like those over Sihon and Og. Well, our text then concludes in verse 5 by saying that as the people were assembled on the plains of Moab, Moses undertook to explain this law. What is this law? Well, it's not a new law. It's the same law that was delivered through Moses at Mount Sinai. And really, the book of Deuteronomy can be likened to a sermon in which Moses is expounding the law and exhorting God's people to keep it. As we noted earlier, this book is a treaty document. It explains why the Israelites owe the Lord their allegiance. It stipulates what that allegiance looks like. And it sets forth blessings for covenant faithfulness. And it also sets forth curses for covenant disloyalty. Now, when you think about the context in which Moses delivered this address, it is surprising that he would focus on an exposition of the law here. You know, Israel is about to go to war against people that, at least according to the majority of the spies, were a pretty formidable foe. They're on the brink of crossing the Jordan to take possession of Canaan, and they're going to have to fight for it. And yet Moses has nothing to say about military strategies or tactics. Israel's focus is to be on the duties to which God has called them. They are to be faithful to the covenant. God himself will take care of the defeat of their enemies. Well, how do we apply a text and a book like this to the church today? Well, our context is clearly different, very different than that of God's people as they prepared to take possession of the promised land. We live at a different point in redemptive history. And yet there are significant parallels between our situation and their situation that do help us, I think, apply these verses to our lives today. First of all, just as the Lord's kingly reign over Israel was mediated by Moses and then by his successor Joshua, God's lordship over us is mediated by Jesus Christ. He is our king. And then second, just as the Lord displayed his faithfulness to his covenant promises by bringing Israel to the brink of Canaan in spite of all of their failures, well, so also does he exhibit his faithfulness to us in Christ, who mediates a better covenant that is enacted on better promises. So in light of that, in light of the fact that we have received a covenant that the writer of the Hebrews describes as far better than that which was established with Israel at Sinai, in light of that, let us take care that we not neglect such a great salvation. May God help us to do so. Amen.